This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
This episode of the Elevate Podcast is brought to you by Law Pods. You want to start your own podcast, just like Rahul and I did about a year ago? Well, I would suggest you talk to our friends at Law Pods. Law Pods are experts in helping attorneys publish podcasts, which is what we're doing here. They help lawyers all over the country, big law firms, small law firms, plaintiffs' firms, defense firms. Their expertise is taking your idea for the podcast and turning it into reality. So check them out at lawpods.com. Our show today is also brought to you by Steno. Steno is a nationwide court reporting service, and as Rahul pointed out, also a technology company that helps you put together not just the stenography, but the video aspects of depositions. They also offer the service for deferred payment. So if you choose, you don't have to pay for the court reporting services until the end of the case, which can be a nice value if you're doing plaintiff's work. Check them out at steno.com. Today's episode is also brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software for plaintiffs, trial firms, used by firms big and small all over the country, including my firm, Gideon Aisen. We love the product. I highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
Rahul, I hear you're heading off to a trial next Monday.
Trial next Monday in Las Vegas, Nevada. Maskless, no restrictions, back to normal.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what that one's about?
Yeah, my client, a Vegas native, he went to a local brewery for a Monday night football game. He ordered a beer. They said the beer might be a little bit flat. Do you want to try a little sample? And he said, sure. They pulled the handle, gave him a sample. He took the sip, and it turned out to be cleaning solvent for the line. So basically like lye. And it went into his stomach. He immediately started vomiting and suffered permanent burns on his tongue, his esophagus, and his stomach. And he's got permanent ulcers and a permanent loss of taste. So that's the case against the brewery.
I like your chances in that one. And also it makes you, if you ever needed a reason to quit drinking, that might be it.
Yeah.
So we're really excited today to have as a guest, Felix Luna. Felix, and I understand your friends call you Gavi, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And are we friends enough that we should call you Gavi, or would you prefer Felix?
Only if I can call you Ben and you Rahul, then we'll be even.
Deal.
Okay, great.
Perfect. So Gavi is a trial lawyer from Seattle, Washington. He's an incredible lawyer, has a whole string of eight-figure amazing verdicts, and hopefully we'll get into some of those. Also tried many civil rights cases, done a lot of pro bono criminal defense cases, inducted in 2018 to the American College, and more recently to the Inner Circle of Advocates. So welcome, Gavi.
Thank you for that introduction. It's totally overblown, but I'll take it for now, Ben.
So it might be nice to start if you wanted to go back and tell us kind of what is your road and journey to becoming a trial lawyer?
Sure. So I grew up in a very large family where growing up, most of the adults' contact with the justice system was through the criminal system when they were on the wrong side of it. Many people in my other generations of my family and my life. And then I moved to Seattle, Washington from Boston when I was in high school, and pretty good at math. So they directed me towards engineering. Probably should have done that. I might have been doing better at this point, but didn't really like that. In college, I really was attracted to social justice issues. So ended up going to law school, really love Moot Court, and actually went to a big firm called Haller Ehrman that had a 120-year run before it folded in 2009 after I left the firm.
You're not responsible for that, I take it.
Absolutely not. Although I did get sued by the bankruptcy folks, even though I'd been gone for 2 years. Anyway, one of my best friends in law school is a third generation lawyer in town named Mike Wampold. And he and I in law school talked about trying cases together and being in a firm together. But at my firm, I'd been doing civil rights work. I'd been trying cases, even though it was a big firm. So I felt pretty good about that. But sort of, you know, 10 years in, I decided I wanted to be full-time trial lawyer. So I ended up at the firm I'm at now. And I've been there for going on 15 years and just love it. Love trial work. Not an athlete, but I can imagine what it's like to run into a stadium. It's sort of how I see going into court. It's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful life and a wonderful job for me. I really love it a lot.
It sounds like, were you the first lawyer in your immediate family, or did you kind of have role model?
Yeah, immediate or extended family. Yeah, I was the first lawyer.
So now you have to do a lot of favors for family members who look for your help.
Every day. And I know I'm not alone in that. Whether we have first, second, or third generation lawyers, all of us spend a lot of time being lawyers for family and friends, and they call you and it's just part of what you do. And yes, for me, and I'm sure for you too, Ben, and you too, Raul, you get the calls all the time. So yeah, that's a big part of what I do. So
how did you learn how to be such an effective advocate in the cases you handle, at least over the last 15 years?
Well, one of my mentors at my first firm, his name is John Phillips, who did civil and both defense and plaintiff work. My firm was a big national litigation firm, but we did a lot of insurance coverage work and actually sued insurance companies. And then we had a very strong pro bono edict. And so we tried cases. And my mentor, John Phillips, I had two of them. John Phillips taught me how to be a trial lawyer. And then I had another person named Peter Dinello and Leonard Feldman who taught me how to write. So John was a trial lawyer and he taught me how to do it. And then I stayed involved in Moot Court through the University of Washington where I went to school and I was a coach. So I would practice my skills I learned from John by teaching other students. And I've done that every year since I graduated in 1997. So that's sort of how I learned. And then just trying cases with him and with the co-counsel, I would learn from them and just stealing and copying like every other trial lawyer. You see somebody do something great and you steal it. So I think that's sort of the way that's been my path anyway.
What about you, your personality? Do you think makes you well suited to try cases, or is that something that you've, that's evolved over time?
I think that anyone can be a good trial lawyer as long as you're authentic. I think that's the number one thing. Credibility and authenticity are the two. Credibility is number one, I think, and authenticity is number two. Just try to be yourself, and we all have our own skills, things we're really good at, things we want to learn from. For me, I think part of it is curiosity. We get cases, and I really like to learn about the underlying science or medicine or engineering principle behind it. I like people, I think, is another thing about me that I think helps. I'm not afraid to take risks as needed, but I would call myself on the spectrum of very, very risk versus very, very cautious in court. I'm closer to risky, but not ultra risky. I mean, I am not the one who gets up there without a very definite plan on cross, for example. I have a very, very definite game plan. My directs, I have a very definite game plan of what I want to accomplish, but you need the room for when you have a feeling of, can I get something that I hadn't anticipated here? So I think all those combined to make that has worked for me. And I think, and again, just watching others, how they do it and listening and not taking yourself too seriously. And when that witness you think is doing great, doesn't matter what I think, it's really what the jury thinks. So I try to stay even keel during trial.
What's your favorite part of trial?
I like closing arguments a lot. I spend a lot of time thinking about that. When I try cases with other people in my firm, I always close and I usually don't open. They don't let me open. I like sort of putting the case together and finding the pieces of the trial that I think work for us and dealing with the times that weren't so great. I mean, we all have that. So I very much enjoy that, interacting with the jury in that way. I like voir dire a lot. It's one of the two times you really get to, well, three times you get to directly interact, but it's the only time where you get direct feedback from jurors. I like expert directs. And it's sort of that back and forth with the expert and the using your illustratives. And so I guess I'm listing a lot of things, but I like all aspects of it, but I can't really, it depends on the case on what's my favorite. But if I had to pick one that I consistently really get jazzed up for, it'd be closing.
I'm interested in that. I mean, you will break up different parts of the trial and say you'll do the closing and somebody else opens, I take it.
Yes.
Do you guys have a thought about how to best structure that if you're having multiple lawyers try a case and which one should be opening and who should be closing? And does the person who closed need to be the one who does the voir dire or certain experts? Do you break it up around liability and damages? Or how do you think about structuring when you have the multiple lawyers at trial?
Yeah. So in my firm, any significant case, we try with two lawyers. And I try lots of cases with Mike Wample, for example. He's just terrific at opening. And so, and he puts literally weeks, if not months, into it. He's just great. So he does opening in almost every case we've done. I can't think of a case where I've opened where he's been my, where we've done it together. And I always do the, at least the liability close, and he'll do rebuttal. That is mixed up a little bit, but it's, that's pretty much how we do it. That's how we work together. When I've worked with other people, I'll do the whole close and I'll have them do opening. And then the way we do it is we really think about who's the best lawyer personality type or based on preparation time for every witness. We actually sit down and we say, why would you be best to handle this witness? And why would you be best to handle that witness? We don't break it down in terms of different areas of the case. We both know all areas of the case, but we think very strategically about how is this witness going to react to you? And then that's how we do it. Sometimes it's tied to the depositions, but usually not. It's usually, you know, whoever can handle the dep handles the dep. But then we sit down and we say, should you handle the wife? And I handle the husband. Why? That sort of thing. And we're very strategic about that, including cross-examinations too. Mike's terrific at cross-examination, and you know, he has the 2x4 as needed. And I don't use a 2x4 as often as he does. And so we might think about it that way. How's the jury going to respond to this witness and how we handle the cross? So every single aspect is thought out in that way.
Yeah, that's really smart. And I do think the jury often likes to have some variation. So seeing different lawyers involved in a trial can be appealing to them. So are there sort of milestones that you can think of, thinking back to your career as a trial lawyer, where kind of the light bulb went off and you had you know, realized things that make you the lawyer you are today at different turning points, significant cases or trials or lessons you learned along the way?
I don't think I'm anywhere near where I'm hoping to be. I mean, the thing about trial lawyers is things change and you learn all the time. I mean, all of us on this call are old enough to remember a time where you didn't use computers at all in trial. You had the, you know, the sheets and the overhead. They're called Elmos. I remember that. And now, if you don't have some video, if you don't have animations, the jurors are wondering, they're getting cheated. So just learning how to adapt as we go in every trial. We're doing Zoom trials now. I mean, 2 years ago, you never heard of Zoom, right? I mean, I remember one thing, I was just hungry to be in court as a law student, and I had the benefit of doing mock trials. So when I got to my firm, I was too dumb to realize I didn't know anything. And so I said, sure, I'll take that witness. And over time, you just evolve certain methods and preparation for getting a witness ready and getting the examinations done right and front loading the key opinions and why. So I would say, I remember my first Med-Mal trial, and Mike and I did it. And he says, now remember, we have to use these certain very specific terms for causation, or we can get knocked out. And, you know, I hadn't tried a Med-Mal case before. And so that was a significant turn. Like certain kinds of cases, you have to have the magic language. I'm using air quotes, even though we're just on audio here. And so just gaining the confidence of, can I handle this witness? Should you hand it off to somebody who's done more cases? And it's like, no, you can handle that. So it's a constant evolution for me. And I would say, you know, I've gotten much more comfortable over the last 10 years with handling the science of the medicine and feeling comfortable with myself on that and not getting worried if the first part of a cross doesn't go great and realizing, okay, I have time and relaxing. So just those techniques. But my next trial is going to be my next learning opportunity. I know that. I mean, my last trial was. And so that's just how I see it. I don't think we're, I think of some of the greats in our business and I talk to them and they're humble and they're like, I learned from you and you learned from me and I stole from this person. It's just how it works. I think that's what's so great about what we do is I don't think we ever stop evolving. Because next year there'll be some other technology we need to use to adapt and pull into our trial work.
Do you have opinions about Zoom trials? What do you think?
So I think it's necessary to get us to have the court systems function. I have been surprised at how well they've worked. I was very skeptical when we decided to have a Zoom platform for trials. But I prefer, I think there's something about human interaction in person that is very much lost. And one of the things are, and Mike mentioned this in the last trial we just did, a very significant case involving a crane collapse. And he said to the jurors, if you were in a courtroom, every time you walk in the room, everybody stands, including the judge. And that's because of the unbelievable position you hold basically in our democracy. And that's sort of lost on Zoom. They don't really understand that. I think it's difficult, unless you've done a trial before, and then none of them have, to appreciate that. And then there's just something about being the human connection that is lost. I think it's a wonderful tool. Otherwise, I think personally for King County, where we live, the response rate for jurors is like 4 or 5 times higher to juror summonses on Zoom. And I hope that in terms of the jury selection process, it never goes away. I think we should use it forever because I think once people get committed, they're going to come down to the courthouse. And there's no reason to have 100 people stuck in a room for 3 days when only, 20% of them have even make it to a courtroom. That's wasteful. So I hope, and we're asking our Supreme Court to allow individual counties to do it the way they want. If any of them ever watch this, I urge them to allow that because it's incredible how much more diverse the jurors are based on Zoom because they don't have to get up and ride a bus or drive down there. And then once they find out, hey, I've been picked for something important, I think they're going to show up. So I think certain aspects of it, I hope we're here to stay, but my last trial was live and yours is going to be live, Raul. And masked or not, I think it's important that we come together physically during some portion of the trial.
Yeah, that makes sense. At this point in our part of the world, we would try cases in any fashion that they would allow them, because we still haven't had significant civil cases tried since the onset of the pandemic. So we would take Zoom or snail mail or carrier pigeon, whatever they want to do, as long as we could do something.
Yeah.
I heard you speak about a case you had tried involving a highway construction defect claim. It was really fascinating. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
I actually had 3 trials right up leading up to the pandemic, and I was in trial on a dental case the day before the jury came in, like 2 days before they shut down the courthouse. So this goes back a few months. So this is in the summer of 2019. My client was a defense attorney, civil defense attorney, young man on his way to work. And he was sitting on the freeway in an area of the freeway that is the most congested and had the highest number of freeway collisions in the whole state for years. And there'd been all sorts of complaints. And the scary and sad thing about it is he was in a, this is a left lane exit. And if you do this kind of work, you know that those are, they're bad ideas because of the, everybody drives fast in the left lane and then you come up on an exit and it's, the problem with us is the way our terrain is in Seattle, we have so much water, they had to make a left lane exit here. But this particular stretch of the freeway, you go through what we call a tunnel because we have the convention center over the freeway. So you're in a little tunnel, then you come out and then people are flying through that and then they come out and then you can hit a backup. And there had been hundreds of crashes and some serious, mostly minor, but hundreds of crashes. Our client was sitting waiting to exit in the left turn, back up at typical time. And this guy who had his own cabinet installation business was in one of those Mercedes Sprinter vans. He's flying through, all of a sudden traffic stops. He can't stop in time. And my client was in a small vehicle and just got creamed, suffered a massive brain injury, was in a coma, nearly died. And so our case was, should they have put in warning signs to warn people who don't regularly use this area of the road that there's going to be stop traffic ahead, which they sort of use all around the state, but for whatever reason, in the worst part of the state, they didn't use them. And so that was our case. And it was a fascinating trial. The state didn't think much of our case. And they said, look, it's the other driver's fault. And, you know, he should have paid attention and we don't need these signs. And so it was a month-long trial with Mike Wampold, and I tried that one together with Jimmy Rogers, who many of a lot of folks know. He's sort of an expert in products cases, and he worked on the case with us too. And our theory was, if they had had the warning signs and they were cheap and easy to put in, then we wouldn't have any of these crashes, including our clients. It was a fascinating trial to just put on the experts in that, lots of expert testimony. The state relied on its own highway design engineer to defend basically his own work, which didn't work for them in that particular case. So one of the arguments they made have to do with, well, what's the cost of doing this? And it would have only cost them $300,000. And so I remember this was in the summer, but Seattle, at least we lost Russell Wilson yesterday. So I don't know how football craze we're going to be after that, but football craze town. And I talked about, you know, the Super Bowl, people spend, you know, $3 million at the time, $3 million for a 30-second spot to reach 100 million people. And I said, well, why do they do that? Because there's lots of eyeballs on this and they think it's worth it. I said, it would have cost the state $300,000 to reach 300 million people in the time frame. And, you know, that's all it would have cost them to reach hundreds of millions of people every day on something way more important than whether you should buy Coke or Pepsi. And so that was one of the things we talked about. Like, it's cheap, it's easy, doesn't take a lot of time. And they have the signs all over the state in areas that aren't as congested. So that was a theme the jurors sort of picked up on. Like, why wouldn't you just put a sign up? So it was a great result for him. And thank goodness for him, he was actually the guy, amazing person, was able to get back to work as a litigator with a brain injury, and phenomenal person, wonderful wife. And we just love him. They had a baby recently and sent us pictures. It's nice to help somebody like that who totally deserves it. And so one of our arguments was, you know, in terms of he's back to work, but he's struggling with the brain injury. And I said to him, if we win this case, you're going to go part-time. That's an order, Marine. So, but he's still working and doing well. So it was a great victory for him. I think for the people too, because they should put the signs up.
Did they put the signs up?
No, they still haven't done it.
They haven't put the signs up? You're kidding me.
It's in review. They got a huge judgment against them, eight-figure judgment. And
what was the verdict?
$18 million.
Congrats.
Yeah, you'd think, you know, for $300,000, you pay $18 million, you'd put a sign up, but they still haven't. So.
And most importantly, where did Russell Wilson end up?
Denver. He went to Denver yesterday.
Did he really?
Yeah. I don't know what it is with Denver. Anybody from Colorado, congratulations. He's a wonderful player. And so I'm not bitter.
No. Well, Rahul, I don't know if you listen to the podcast, but he's unfortunately a Bills fan, so we have to live with that.
Tortured soul.
Hey, man, your quarterback is a monster. I mean, that guy, he had 9 touchdowns and 12 incompletions in the playoffs. That's just phenomenal. So you got a good future. I'm from Boston, so Patriots are my first love, and I think we're in for a while here before we catch up to Josh Allen and your guys.
Well, you guys got Mac Jones. He's actually a great pickup. So
I like Mac Jones. I think he is good. Yeah.
Well, that really, really is a great result. One of the things when I saw you present on that, Gavi, was the visuals that you used to assist in making the arguments. And obviously we can't see those through an audio podcast, but can you just describe some of the ways you presented that evidence you just described to us visually?
Yeah. So I have a 14-year-old son, and everybody's so visual now, right? People learn through visual cues, and you know, everybody's on their devices, and it's just another thing that when we all started, you didn't even have cell phones, really. They were so new, you might have had a BlackBerry, right? So I always think about, in every case I try, how do I visually show what I'm trying to explain? Because there's the audio and the visual medium, and you have to go back and forth, and people learn different ways. So I thought hard about, well, how do I show them how simple this is? So one of the things we did is we took pictures of the road and had somebody do a mock-up of what a sign would look like above the freeway and where it would be. Just very simple. Didn't cost hardly any money to do this at all. And so that's one of the things we did. We said, so here's what it would have looked like. And we made it seem it's not ugly, it's not distracting, it's actually easy to put in. The state can run when this, it only comes on when it's actually backed up. So we took the road and we said, okay, here's what it was like, and we showed no sign, and then we put a sign up. Very, very simple. So that's one of the things we did. Just, and we put the van that hit him, what the van's perspective would have been from inside the vehicle pulling up to the getting on the freeway, and you see a sign that reads stop traffic ahead, and how the person would respond to that. And then another one a quarter of a mile into the tunnel, and just put it right above. We work with our reconstruction expert so that the visual cue would have been what he would have seen. So that's a very simple thing. The other thing we did is we took a map of the state and we put all the places by number they had these signs, so that you're looking at the state as the jury, like, they have these everywhere. Why don't they have it where it's most needed? We had another thing I did, which was sort of a timeline, because they have these things called high accident locations. And so, like, when they first knew it was a high accident location on a timeline. And then we put the number of crashes before they designated it, the number of crashes between when they designated it and our guy's injury. And then because they were arguing it was still a safe road, we were able to put post-accident collisions. And so you see this timeline of all of these crashes at this stretch of road. And I actually had that printed out, because I like to have, not everything needs to be on PowerPoint, in my opinion. So I made a board of the timeline and left it in the courtroom. So it's like a rectangular 6 feet long, and it has dates with crashes next to it. And, you know, I just left it. So, you know, the jury could see it walk. It's leaned up against the bench, but whenever I had a witness, I'd put it up and I'd say, obviously this is, you know, pre-COVID, so we're in the courtroom together and I'm looking at these, the timeline and the crashes all the time. So those are the three ways we sort of use visual cues to help tell the story.
First of all, that's amazing. And I'd love to see some of those visuals, because it just sounds like it would be very effective. But kind of reeling it back a little bit to voir dire, when you're going against a public entity, were there certain questions or areas you inquired with to identify whether there'd be closed-minded jurors?
You know, that's one area where I just need to do more stealing, because I know for example, Rick Friedman and others, I know he's been on your podcast, and others are just so darn good at getting at voir dire and really focusing in on the right jurors and getting the bad jurors to talk themselves out of being jurors. And I've always had so many good jurors talk themselves out of being jurors by saying I can't be fair. It's very frustrating for me. So, but one interesting thing about our jury selection is, so we do lots of medical negligence cases where it's the white knight you're suing, and doctors are actually there to do good, and they care, and they're good at speaking, and because that's part of the job, right? So we have a lot of experience with talking to jurors about the idea that the defendant here isn't a polluter, isn't a drunk driver, isn't a bad, you know, somebody you would consider have done something bad, but somebody who's trying to do the right thing and trying to be helpful and causing harm. Okay. Like a physician or the highway design. I mean, they're trying to move us around the state safely, and they spend hundreds of millions of dollars of our tax money to do it. And so, but they also held to a standard. And so, you know, we talk a lot about the concept of bringing claims against people who are trying to do the right thing and not getting it done. So that's part of our voir dire, and just getting people to acknowledge that you're still responsible, even though you have a good intention. So we have so many engineers in Seattle that, you know, we're going to get engineers on our juries. It's just going to happen, right? So we focus on that concept and people who can accept that idea that, yes, you're trying to do the right thing. You have a noble job or a noble profession, and yet you're responsible. And so we'll say things like, one example we've used is somebody is picking up clothes for a clothing drive for a homeless shelter. And they stop at several places to pick up. And while they're driving, they, you know, get distracted by a phone call from one of the other homeless shelters. And they look down, and before they can look back up, they hit somebody in a crosswalk. How do you feel about that? Like, should they be respected? And so it's sort of like they're a volunteer, right? They're doing the ultimate good, and yet they cause harm. And get people to understand that concept is one example. We won't, you know, we can't obviously use the exact example of your case, but we do those sorts of things. And, you know, generally, people who work for insurance companies, we try to shy away from that. Engineers are tough, but what we do with the engineers, we make deals with them. You know, we say, listen, your job is 99.9% perfection, or if something really bad happens, you know, the law is 51%. How do you feel about that? Can you accept that? And we get them to, and then when they do, we say, look, sort of, you're going to follow the law. And like, when you get back in there, you can't apply the 99%. Do you accept that? And so to the extent, you know, we have them, that's sort of the discussions we have. But it's tough. I mean, we, you know, a lot of our cases are like that, though. We've chosen a lane where most of the time it's people who are trying to do the right thing, and they just have mistakes.
We want to thank our sponsors for today's show, Hype Legal. Hype Legal is the place to go for great websites, great digital marketing for plaintiff's trial lawyers. The company started by two guys named Micah and Tyler, who spent decades working at High Impact, which does graphics for trial graphics and animations for trial lawyers. Rahul and I got to know them over the years they worked there, loved the work they did. And now they started their own company where they're putting that same talent to work for you in digital marketing. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Today's episode is also brought to you by our friends at the Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go to help you locate the right experts to help you prepare to work up your case and to try your case. They focus on doing only one thing and doing one thing really well, and that's helping you with the expert part of your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. I'm fascinated by that line of questioning about noble professions, because most of what I do is medical cases too. And do you think that that is still something that is needed, or do you feel, because one of the things that I feel like I've learned is that many people, maybe that's changed with COVID, but many people have a lesser view of the medical profession today than they might have, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, because many people's experiences interacting with the medical establishment isn't all that great. You know, they wait around in the waiting room for hours. They feel like the doctors don't listen to them. They fly in and out for a couple of minutes and so forth. But on the other hand, people do tend to like their own personal doctors. And do you think that's still a really important thing to do in these cases, the noble profession line of voir dire?
I think you nailed it, Ben, in which is, I think people who are impacted by the system of medicine, it's just like this, all politics is local. I know you've heard that before, right? Like, people hate Congress, but they keep voting for the same representatives because they say, well, my representative is okay. I just hate Congress. People do, I think, identify with their doctors, and then, but they don't like the profession. And so what I have found, which is sort of frustrating, is those people who are super frustrated with the medical profession, they never make it onto the juries because they're always like, I hate, you know, every time I go to the doctor, they don't listen and I can't be fair. And so those people get themselves kicked off of juries, right? And so if there's any stealth jurors, it's not on our side. It's against us. It's those people that say I can be fair when they really are just all their friends are doctors or their family members and they can't. You know, that tends to be. So the people who really, really love their doctors don't make it because they say, I can't do it. My best friend's a doc. And the people who hate doctors get themselves off. So we're left with all those people in the middle who might have some contact with the healthcare profession. And so they think, goodness, if I ever need a doctor, I want one, right? So we just, in my experience, at least when, in my cases, I've never, those people you're talking about always either say they can't be fair or they get excluded for cause. And so I'm working with those people who are sort of have some contact and know it's tough to be a doctor and but don't have a strong view one way or the other, but understand that, you know, this isn't a polluter who or an insurance company who committed bad faith. And so I put my bad faith cases that I've done. I mean, if any of you have done those, talk about wind at your back, right? It's really them trying to figure out, can I get anybody fair on my side as the defense? But I have found it's those people who have some contact. They might have a family member who has a doctor they like, or they see their doctor once a year and think he or she is great, but otherwise don't have many opinions. Those are the ones I get. So that's why we sort of say the doctors in our case are trying to do the right thing. I've had a doctor who I brought two claims against who was on drugs during a surgery. Now that, I don't have to do that discussion, right? And they admitted fault. So that wouldn't come in as an example. So that's sort of been my experience, but I think you're right. I mean, I think to the extent you have sort of the corporatization of medicine issues in your case, I think you're right. I don't think it's as important. Or if you're suing an institution that has bad policies, it's not as important.
Raul is really the guru of voir dire, so he may have thoughts about it.
No, I always get nervous. I always look at it as jury deselection. So I spend a lot of time trying to identify those adverse jurors. And usually it's through questions that are framed towards the negative issues in the case, whether, you know, taxpayer protection on a public entity case. Anybody thinks it's their own money that they're going to have to pay on this, and we'll be thinking about that as they're deliberating on damages. But it is it's a fascinating thing, voir dire and jury selection, for the same reason you said, Gavi. It's the one time we actually get to interact with total strangers who are going to be passing judgment on a case.
Yeah. Well, one thing, Ro, it's interesting you brought that. It reminded me of my highway design case. One of our potential jurors was a guy named Dory Monson, who is a local radio personality. He does the Seahawks. He has a radio show. He's a conservative commentator, and he hates large verdicts, okay? But he hates the state, and he hates the attorney general. And he actually has publicly feuded with the attorney general, and the attorney general was defending the case. So talk about what you do with this guy, right? And he basically says, I don't like large verdicts, but I hate the state more. And he was he's funny. He's a funny personality. I mean, it's why he's a, you know, personality on the radio. And so we were just thinking, what are we going to do with this guy? Like, you know, ultimately we used a peremptory on him. I think he didn't serve, but he says, he goes, I don't like either one of you. I'm perfect. I'm totally neutral. I don't like you because you're asking for millions of dollars. And I really don't like you because I think you're ruining the state in terms of the attorney general. So talk about what you do with that, right? The taxpayer issue versus how's he going to come down? But neither side wanted to take the risk. So, because, you know, he would have just run roughshod over everybody because he was just very, very good at what he does. So anyway, sorry for that aside.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So, Gavi, you recently had another amazing verdict, this time in a different venue that's a little bit more challenging, to say the least, both in terms of the demographics, but also some of the court rules. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah. So my last trial was an in-person trial in Arizona, in Maricopa County, and it was fascinating. I go to Arizona quite a bit. It's a, you know, I like going there to visit, and obviously the weather's great. And it's much more conservative area than King County, where I live and practice most of the time. We had a judge who was a stickler for the rule, but super fair, super great. I mean, if you didn't have your briefs right, it's getting rejected. And that's on both sides. There was no favoritism on anybody. It was very balanced. Took his job incredibly seriously. Let us be heard. But he runs the courtroom in a way like a federal judge. He practiced for years in big commercial practice, and so had tried cases. And so you had to follow the rules to a T to get in the footnotes right. And it was just great going in, because obviously the local counsel is key. And he says, you know, you got to be careful. And so we had to be careful. But I actually very much enjoyed the trial, practicing in front of him, because just the way he handled it. The case was a medical negligence case involving my client, who was an engineer. He was visiting Arizona for midwinter break with his wife and kids. And he had some minor hand weakness, and then didn't think much of it. The wife thought, I want to make sure this is okay. She gets on the internet, doesn't see anything that says this is serious, goes to sleep. He wakes up and he can't speak. So he's obviously having a stroke, but he otherwise was mentally fine, could move, could walk, couldn't speak well, but could, you know, move his mouth and could think and could text and walk and all of that. Pretty minor symptoms. So he's taken to the only comprehensive stroke center in Arizona at the time, called Banner University Medical Center. They get him in the scanner. They confirm it's not a bleed. They confirm it's a stroke from what they call carotid artery dissection, where the lining tears. So from our perspective, and everyone's perspective, the standard of care, the defense agrees, what they're supposed to do is to give him aspirin. But they didn't. And he sits around until 4 o'clock. He has a massive stroke, and now he can't work, doesn't speak well, has a massive brain injury, and basically altered his life completely. He was a high wage earner. They had a wonderful home, everything. And he can't really be a dad like he was. He can't work, and he's very, very disabled. So the issue in the case was the timing of aspirin. Our experts said he needed to get it right away. The defense theory was, as long as he gets it within 24 hours, the standard of care is met. And that was the whole case. And so we brought in our experts that said, look, everybody agrees he needs to get it. There's absolutely no reason to delay it. Delaying it can be very problematic, and you can have a stroke, because when you have a stroke that's caused by a clot, there's a certain window. It's called the TPA window, where they can give you a clot buster. But after that, all you can do is prevent a second stroke in terms of stopping the actual dead brain tissue. He was beyond the window for the clot buster because of these symptoms he'd had that nobody knew about when he finally shows up. Interestingly, it's between 10 and 20%. Only 10 to 20% of people actually show up in time to get TPA. Most people show up after because they don't know, especially for a minor stroke. Now, if you get a major stroke, they know. You know, you fall out, you can't speak, they know. But most people with minor symptoms don't realize it, and so they show up late. And that's why aspirin is the key medication. So the whole trial was about, did they violate the standard of care as the hospital and the physicians by not giving him the medication right away? The doctors in their deposition said, of course we give it right away. That's standard of care. At trial, they tried to back off because they had this theory based on guidelines that, well, when I said right away, I meant within 24 to 48 hours. So that was one of my arguments in closing, was like, anybody with kids, when they ask you for something, say a dessert, and they say, when can I have the dessert? And you say now, and then you say, I meant 12 hours from now. Everybody knows that's just horse manure. I didn't use that term, but that's basically the implication. Like, now is now and 24 hours is not now. And so that was a big theme. And then a big part of our case was the policies and procedures at the hospital were not clear as to who gives the medication, who's responsible for giving it, should they give it in the emergency department or after, and who basically who's on first was a big part of our case. Ultimately, and we used lots of visual aids to tell the story. We had an animation done of basically the dissection happening and then the clot forming around the dissection and then going up and clogging a different artery and then the brain death. So we spent lots of time on that. And we had getting that admitted was a chore, just each step of it. Arizona has, compared to Washington, it's a different planet in terms of disclosure obligations. In Arizona, you must disclose everything you're going to use, including for impeachment, including medical literature you may use with an expert, including prior testimony you may use with an expert, including every theory and the basis for every theory. Now, every state has that in terms of the theory, but I have never seen a situation where you have to disclose purely impeachment information at some point in discovery. So that was news to us. Even some of the way I phrase some of my, as an example, like whether the hospitalist, which is basically the internal medicine doctor, who's like your family doctor, but inside the hospital, whether we could refer to that role as the quarterback of the care. They objected to that because we didn't use the word quarterback at a deposition. It was sustained because, again, in Arizona, every theory, every basis. And so it was a learning experience, but, you know, the judge applied it to both sides. So that's the rule. And if you're going to try a case in Arizona, those prior depositions that you plan to pull out and stick in front of an expert, just disclose them at some point during discovery. Because if you don't, you can't use them. It's just, and including the literature. Make sure you've put it on a list. My recommendation is to put, if you plan to use 10 or 15, maybe put 25 or 30. So they don't know which ones you're going to, that's just a practice point. But put them up, because in Arizona, you don't get to use it. And the judge was very firm and very clear on that. He said, look, I think I'm quoting him correctly. We have the most strict disclosure obligations in the country, and Nevada is second. So Raul, be ready for that in Nevada. He said, Nevada is adopting Arizona's view on this, but Arizona is very, very firm on this issue. So that's something for anybody who's practicing in Arizona. And Washington, it's very different. We don't disclose impeachment materials. If an expert has a new opinion really late, there's a thing called the Burnett factors. And I have been in many trials, including our firm's last trial, where they did depositions during the trial because some new opinions cropped up and they weren't excluded. In Arizona, you go to jail for that. It's that far apart. So just make sure you've let them know everything about your case. The jury in my case concluded that it was really the hospital's procedures and policies being, they described this as a compromise verdict. I think lots of jurors wanted to get the doctors as well, but they ended up ultimately finding against the hospital, saying this was an error, but it was on the hospital. And a huge issue in my case was causation. Would aspirin have prevented the second stroke? And so we had to explain that one of the things we had to prove is that the clot that caused a second stroke formed while he was at the hospital. Because if it was already there, aspirin is much less likely to stop the second stroke. But if you don't get new clots with aspirin. So that was a huge part of the case with all the experts fighting about that. And the jurors ultimately concluded that, look, if everybody's supposed to get aspirin, aspirin doesn't let you get clots. They concluded the clot formed at the hospital, and that's why we ultimately prevailed. So it was a great case. Being in Arizona in November, not bad, when Seattle is Seattle in November.
And there was something interesting that happened during deliberations. Tell us about that.
Yes. So it was all in person, and then the jurors asked lots of questions during deliberations, but at some point they said, we're deadlocked. They didn't say on what issue, but they said, we're deadlocked. And it's an 8-person jury in Arizona. We have to get 6. And they said, we're deadlocked. And they didn't say what the split was, but it looked like it was 4-4. So we thought, oh gosh, we're going to have to come back and do this again. And then Arizona has what we all call the dynamite instruction, but it's a fascinating instruction because what it reads is, let us know if there's anything we can help you with. Most of them just say, lots of money's been spent, go back and deliberate, basically get it done. And then I thought what's fascinating about it is the jurors have been asking us for help for 3 days and we gave them none, right? And so then they get this dynamite instruction. And then they asked a question about one of the policies. And then I found a case in Arizona that was really fascinating. I've never seen this, where they allowed a mini closing argument on the juror question that goes in connection with the dynamite instruction. So we started getting ready for a 10-minute closing. And then the jurors got the instruction, got an answer to a question about something about the policy. I can't remember exactly what it was. And then we're sitting around again. So now they're 4 days waiting for a verdict in Arizona. And then they come back and they have a question. They say, now that we've resolved liability, should we just move on to damages? And we're like, yes, move on to damages. You don't have any more questions. So they definitely telegraphed.
Tell us how you felt when you received that note.
I mean, we were yelling and dancing in the room because we were like, you know, we'll come back and do it for this family, but we didn't want to go back and try this case again. Anybody, Ben knows this, Raul probably does too. Mad Mal cases are 6 figures all day. And that's just money that you spend to get them there. And that's anyone. And this one was very expensive, took a month out of our lives in Arizona. So we didn't care at that point if they gave us $1 or 10 million. We were like, great. So that was a very, very nice feeling. So now we're just waiting around. And the way the Arizona questions, the jury questions work in Arizona, causation's embedded into the question. So it's not negligence, causation, because I know we've lost cases on causation. Ben may have too, where you win the first point, but they're like, it wouldn't have mattered. So the way the question came in was clear. They'd answered yes on both, because they don't go to damages unless they've answered both questions. It's not, we found liability, now what do we do? It's like, how do we handle the damages? So it was wonderful feeling. And then what was really fascinating is we had planned, the judge was going to excuse the jury at like 4 o'clock. So we had a flight home and we thought they'd come back and do damages on the Monday. So we're at the airport and the judge says, the jury's gone, you can leave. Then we get a call from the bailiff, jury's back. So we had to like hop in Ubers, take our luggage and run back to the courthouse for the verdict. So that was a nice ride. So it was wonderful. The family is great. It's a wonderful family. The wife is, my client's wife is incredible. And you know, it's going to be appealed, as all of us know that happens. But for now, we feel really good about it.
Well, Gavi, congrats on that verdict. It was really, having heard the facts of the case, I thought it was a really hard case and you got an amazing result for your client. I know Rahul has a court hearing he's got to leave for, but we really appreciate your time today and coming on the show. This was a terrific episode.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Gavi.
Thank you, and good luck, Rahul. I like your case. I like your chance in Nevada. So
next time we got to get the camera working so everyone can see you, but we'll at least get a better job.
Well, I don't think you need to see me. So you guys take care. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for doing this. This is fun. Take care.
No, you too.
Take care. Thanks.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.